Welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
To me, being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
When you can understand the person, you can then work towards a common goal.
We are all on the same team.
Know your role and do it to the best of your ability.
Focus on the fundamentals. We've gone over time and time again.
Your defense has got to be better.
Leave no doubt tonight.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast, where we believe that there is no algorithm for leadership, and so we interview great sports coaches from around the world to try and find ideas to help all of us be better leaders. Our great coach on this episode is Barry Dancer. Barry is a former Australian field hockey player and coach of the Australian men's national field hockey team. As a player, he competed in 48 international matches for Australia between 1973 and 1979, and was a member of the team that won a silver medal at the 1976 Summer Olympics. He began coaching late in his career as a player, eventually going on to lead the Great Britain men's team at the 2000 Olympics. In 2001, he was then appointed the head coach of the Australian men's team and led them to two Commonwealth Games golds, two Champions trophies, and an Olympic gold in 2004 and bronze in 2008. Barry is a coach with a deep well of wisdom, built from many years of successes and failures. The highlights of our interview for me were how he challenges himself each day with the questions, "What have I done today to improve the way that I or my people do things?" The learnings he has on managing workload and obsession as a coach and finding a balance that allows you to maintain your energy. And the way he talks about the idea of belonging and using it to remind people of the privilege of being part of something that has a long history and a bright future. And just before we go to the interview with Barry, if you enjoy listening to the podcast and would like to learn more, you can head over to our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com. There you will find exclusive audio and video content for subscribers taken from the more than 150 interviews that we have done with some of the world's great coaches. The content is downloadable, shareable, and designed to start a conversation around the dinner table, locker room, or boardroom table. We also have a newsletter that features information on our latest podcasts, leadership insights from our guests, recommendations they have on books or other media, as well as information on how you can engage with other people who listen to the podcast on our live events. All of that information and more is at our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com. And now, please enjoy our interview with Barry Dancer.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Barry Dancer, good morning and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Yeah, good morning, Paul, and good to be with you.
Thank you so much for making the time today, Barry. And could I start by asking you where you are in the world and what you've been up to so far?
I'm at home. My wife and I live on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, and it's a beautiful morning, so I've just been up and had some breakfast and done a few chores, and be a beautiful day outside to enjoy when we're finished here.
Well, thank you for taking a little bit of time to us to talk about all things hockey, gold medal, the Olympics, and mental health and all the other issues we'll get into as we go along. But Barry, I want to start by just asking you, you've coached in India, you've coached in Great Britain and Australia, you've coached local hockey from all the way up, from grassroots all the way up across youth teams to national teams. So I'm sure you've seen some good and perhaps some not so good coaches along the way. But when you reflect back, what do you think the great coaches do differently that sets them apart?
Probably more some things about what they have in common. Obviously, they have athletes that are winners. I've had a role in assisting those athletes become winners, primarily I think because they develop very strong relationships with their athletes. They've been students of their sport over a long period of time, so they've got quite a strong and clear vision of what it takes to win and the conviction to keep on that path and keep true to that path. They all have a strong sense of purpose and duty, and that results in such a strong work ethic. They're prepared to embrace challenges and some of the pressures that go with performing in a public arena. Certainly, I think a lot of them are prepared to make and have to be prepared to make difficult decisions, have the candid conversations that sometimes are very unpopular with individuals or groups, but always would be doing that in the best interest of the program or their athletes. And they're continually searching for new ideas, new knowledge as a means of innovation and keeping ahead of the competition. So for me, that's sort of, that's some of, if I look at the things that, when I look at the great coaches I've had experience of working with, observing, reading about, their thoughts come to mind.
Barry, you were brought up in regional Queensland. I'm not sure if I can call Ipswich regional Queensland, but it's definitely a big town that's not a city. How did growing up there go on to influence your approach to leadership?
Well, I always consider myself very fortunate to have grown up in Ipswich, and particularly the sporting community there. And it has had a significant influence on my thoughts on life, community, how I might act as a coach. So during my childhood, I probably started playing sport as most people did in the primary school years. So through those years and into my high school, had a significant influence because I was observing people behave. Observing a lot of people giving a lot of their time as volunteers for the local associations and different coaching groups and whatever that was going on. I saw people that stood on their principle and were prepared to make difficult decisions and, again, sometimes unpopular decisions for the best interests of the association or the club or the team that they're responsible for. I saw a lot of senior players in the clubs that I was associated with and the organisations I was associated with, developing great camaraderie within the group. But also they're very welcoming of new players, young players. And to me, a lot of those behaviours exemplified and identified for me things that I saw as important in a community to make it thrive and the people in it make it thrive. So I just think that was a model for me about not just how I needed to behave in the future, but if I became a leader in a group, how I needed to put those ingredients into that community.
And then this idea of community starts to form a little bit, I guess, in the latter stages of your international career. When you started coaching, you were still a player. And what was the impetus back then to move you in that direction?
I think in my school years, I was always interested in learning and reading about significant events and how they occurred and what people did, and particularly leaders as to how they influenced and led different things. And those things could be sporting groups, but they could be other endeavours. Then I just followed my nose into teaching. And I think teaching was a bit about influencing others. But it's also I enjoyed the school environment and the students. So it was just what am I going to do when I leave school? And there it was. At the time I was becoming a teacher, I was also an international player. So my teaching accompanied my international playing career. Towards the end of my international playing career, I decided to relocate to Perth. And the reason for that was about joining a larger pool of players as a training environment. And I thought in those days without full-time training, I just need to train with better players more regularly, assist my development as a player, establish myself more on the national team. And that was beneficial. But what happened during that time in Perth is I got exposed to some coaching things. The local WA Department of Sport and Rec was a leader nationally. Had some coach development programs they were operating. By coincidence with a person I live with, a hockey person, who was also a car salesman, he introduced me to a video of Vince Lombardi and the second effort, which a lot of people will know of. A few other things happened. So when I came back to Queensland at the end of that year, basically to marry my now wife, and that was the main reason for coming back, I started to take on more coaching roles. So instead of just coaching a club and a school team. I ended up coaching a rep team, and then it went on and on and on. So all of a sudden, it was taking up more time probably than my day job. And I think it was that bit of a turning point in that time in Perth and then coming back. The purpose I went to Perth was develop more as a player. When I came back, taking on more coaching roles actually was detrimental to my playing career. Spent more time on a hockey pitch directing and organising and coaching and developing myself. And then serendipity took a hand, because at the end of the 80s, I was approached to take on a role as a full-time coach at the AIS. So that was a big turning point and opportunity to turn what was a passion and a part-time role into a full-time role. So I was fortunate that the system here in Australia had matured. There were coaching positions in hockey where there hadn't been previously. So all of a sudden I'm there full-time coaching.
It's a great apprenticeship. It starts obviously back in Ipswich. And as you've just said there, you didn't mention the Olympic silver medal, of course, but you pick up the Olympic medal, you coach, you move all along, and you get to the Australian Institute of Sport. But what I wanted to ask, this is a great apprenticeship, but what I wanted to ask you actually, Barry, was what did this apprenticeship not prepare you for when you became a head coach for the first time?
Well, I became a head coach for the first time after about half a dozen years of being at the AIS. So I took up a role with Hockey in England as the national coach, head coach of the men's program. And I think it's not an uncommon story. Whilst I felt technically and tactically I was well prepared for the role, it was the lack of management skills that probably exposed me most. And when I look back, that's a common story I hear with coaches moving into head coaching position, from just being a technical coach or a specialist coach or an assistant coach or being a player. And some athletes have moved directly into head coaching roles from their playing days. And there are certainly various issues in terms of management that I could have dealt with better when I reflect back. And it was a great learning experience in preparation for my role here, coming back to take on the head coach of the Kookaburras program after 2000. And things that stand out, I could have taken more time in terms of recruitment of rather important roles in our support staff. I felt pressured to make a couple particularly quickly because of impending competition and so forth. I certainly could have had a significantly better role in developing the culture within the group. It was an interesting time for hockey in England because they just got lottery funding. They were moving out a very amateurish rivalry, internal rivalry between coaches was rampant because they'd been coaching against each other in club competitions. Now they were vying for national positions, in whether they're in a network or whether they're in team coaching, national coaching roles. There was still rivalry within the playing group. There were different divisions built around club competitions that had, you know, been well ingrained, and therefore there wasn't a national sort of focus in their minds and a togetherness yet. So I could have dealt with some of that more in the early days. And then also, I suppose, key thing for me was about, I learned a lot more about what it takes to win at Olympic level, because it was still in its growing pains and formative years, that system. So from nobody, all of a sudden, after 2 or 3 years that I was there with the performance director, there was about 70 staff. But the maturity of that system was limited. So, you know, there was an attitude of, well, we've got some excuses here now. We haven't quite got the support system in place. How can we be expected to win an Olympic medal? And so the expectation wasn't as high as it needed to be, because it wasn't built on a genuine belief that had been developed over some time, and developing a no excuses mentality on the part of the players and support staff in a team based on providing them with the level of support they require, which has to be at least the equal of the opposition, was a key learning curve. So having all those pieces in place was something that I took away, and it drove me to make sure we had all the pieces in place when I took on the next role, whether that be England after 2000 or whether GB after 2000 or, as it turned out, Australia after 2000. And one of the key things for me was learning also about the need to manage up, because I felt I was, again, relatively inexperienced and didn't take that as a necessary step, and learnt from that experience the need to really manage up and develop expectation on the part of the people that oversee the program and fund the program as well.
Fascinating story. And before we get the gold medal, though, and the breaking of that Kookaburra curse, I want to just pause for a minute, because you talk about, you know, all these learnings you had. You reference them as management skills. And yet, I was listening to an interview you did just recently, and you described the role of the head coach now as being a facilitator. And I'm just wondering, it's a big leap from, you know, describing these management skills you have to now being able to describe the role as being a facilitator. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I suppose those comments were driven by ultimately what I saw the role of the coach as. And that primarily was a developer of people, whether it be the athletes, the support staff, anybody else involved in the program. When it comes down to nuts and bolts, it's about developing the people. So it's how you see your role as a developer and assisting the development of people. When we came back to Australia, our daughter, who has some disabilities, was supported by Cerebral Palsy Association in WA. And one of my great learnings with taking her to those sessions of the morning was seeing the case management meetings around her development and how they approached with a group of service providers, an individual plan, inviting input from the parents. Amy at that stage was probably only about 3 years of age at the oldest. About three. And they were very consultative. There was no clear leader. They shared the leadership around the table when those discussions happened. So that case management scenario, you know, sort of morphed into my role as a head coach, facilitating those meetings around an athlete's development. So Colin Batch and I would meet with an athlete regularly to review their development, but really the service team around that athlete would play the role of collaborating, identifying priorities as well. So to me, it wasn't one person with the athlete on an individual basis or one person with a staff member on an individual basis. It was a collaborative approach, and I saw my role as a head coach is make sure we've got the right people, good people around an individual that can provide the guidance and support they need. And then having facilitated that group of people, the process that goes on with that. So if I think about the ultimate thing, for me, the ultimate thing is to get the athlete or the person, whoever it is, to the stage where they can self-direct their own development. Let's get the athlete to that point and where they can not only self-direct their own development, but they can have a bit of say and a fair bit of input into self-directing the program and how it can move forward and make the group better. So I suppose if I think about the facilitating role, I think there's leadership, there's guidance, there's whatever, but ultimately if we focus on the individual and what our purpose, our daily purpose is, then I become a facilitator amongst other roles. It's not the sole role, obviously.
You mentioned daily purpose there, and you also referenced the word purpose in the opening when talking about great coaches. Did you get to a point in your time as the head coach of the Kookaburras where you could define that purpose? Did you put it into words?
My personal purpose?
Yeah.
Yes. I don't think it's interesting how you reflect and how you think as a person, and at different stages you're moving and your own growth, so it's easy to look back and reflect and think about things that caused you to change, and it's important to do that, and so if I think about my daily purpose, it's very clear to me, and I have written notes about today, And it probably comes back to one of the things that will crop up later. It's my daily purpose was about assisting people grow, assisting the collective growth as much as the individual growth, and not forgetting the individual growth. So a key thing for me was firstly coaches identifying that they are serving people as well as organizations achieve goals. And if you get to the nuts and bolts of it, it's really about the individual growth that you're focusing on most, and then the collective growth. You know, when people in, let's say, more professional sports buy athletes in and identify the pieces that can win the put together in a puzzle, they're talking a lot more about the collective growth. But I'm sure they don't neglect the individual growth of their people either. So I always come back to that individual growth aspect, and as a result of that, the collective growth will grow, will happen anyway.
Barry, you were the coach who broke what was called the Kookaburra curse when you won the Olympic gold in Athens in 2004. When you were the coach, this is a team that is draped in history. It's a storied team. There are famous coaches that came before you, and there are many stories about those teams. But I'm really, what I wanted to ask you about is, how did you find this balance between looking back to create that sense of belonging, but also orientating the team forward so they could go on and break this curse that had been around the team for a while?
Well, I think the business about sense of belonging is sort of looking back. There's no doubt about that, considering the past. And the sense of belonging is something that is particularly a strong motivator. It motivates us all. We want to belong. We want to feel valued, all of those things. So for our group, it was important for people to understand and value the privilege of being part of the program and the responsibility that went with that, but not let the responsibility overtake you, which was part of this Kookaburra curse, maybe. But it's also about people feeling valued, and to understand that to feel valued and respected, they had to earn that through their own effort and commitment. So the need for belonging and not letting people down became an extremely motivating factor in our group. And for me, they go hand in glove. I mean, to look forward, it's interesting. I used to drive to the AIS hockey unit in Perth, and one of the entrances into the Curtin University precinct, you drive in, and on the side on a limestone wall was a comment from John Curtin. I don't know. I've never found where it's written, but it said, look forever forward. And it's a great couple of words that I've learned to treasure as I've, it'll probably come up later in conversation, but look forever forward is always about, maybe people have different connotations of that, but I think you can only look forward if you understand the past and build on the past. So for me, linking that past, getting the balance right, to use it as a motivator, was an important part of what we were as the Kookaburras. And I think one of the values that really the Kookaburras still to this day is important to them. Understand their history, the responsibility that goes with that, leave the legacy in a better place than when they arrived. All of those things are important. And you know, I think that feeling of being involved in something greater than just the now and me, being involved in something that's longer lasting, that has a greater and wider impact, is a significantly important thing for everybody in life. So for the Kookaburras and the organisation around it, the hockey in Australia, yeah, I think people want to build on that tradition, and it's a very proud tradition.
Barry, I've got a quote from you I'd like to read before I ask the question. And you say, because there's many times in my career where I've got in the way and as a result caused players to maybe question their own ability and have a lack of confidence. And so really I need to be careful that I'm not intruding in a way that demotivates. It was a great quote, and I was very much intrigued about it. I'm wondering what advice you have now on making sure that you don't get in the way as the leader.
I'm not sure what that particular quote related to, but I've got a suspicion. And maybe I can make some comments about when I think and how not to get in the way and why not to get in the way. But I'll also like the comment about when coaches need to make a deliberate decision and a well-considered decision about the need to get in the way and how they best do that. So for coaches, it's particularly important you don't get in the way in competition. Get in the way of the athlete's thinking, particularly in some way undermining their confidence. So I think certainly the aspect of confidence and providing confidence for the player and assisting them remain confident, not cluttering their minds in competition, not distracting them, not creating static is so important. So for me, some of the things about keeping out of the way, I think that comment might have related to when I publicly criticised a player or two in the middle of an Olympic competition and almost derailed our Olympic success in 2004. An inadvertent comment in a press conference after a game that I thought was nothing because a player had probably or two had acted against some of the team ethic. But it was evident 2 days later when a player came to me on the front of the next match to say something like, "Do you think I'm a prima donna?" And what I hadn't realised was in those days, even at the birth of things like Facebook that didn't even exist, I think, until 2004, things can spread. They can become viral. And he was significantly affected and distracted in the middle of Olympic competition and demotivated and, again, a lot of static in his mind. And that rings true with other things I do or would have done or could do to get in the way. And some of those are about, I believe, trying to make adjustments to technique and provide too much information during competition as well. And just sometimes that's necessary. Sometimes adjustments in technique, something that needs to be given by way of advice is important in the middle of competition, but it's a very dangerous area to go into because it could cause doubt and therefore undermine confidence. So that's something I would suggest be wary of. But some helpful behaviours to keep out of the way is yourself. Behave in a calm and composed way, which provides confidence to the athlete. Certainly about ensuring the environment's free of unnecessary distractions for them or minimising the distractions around the competition. And again, in your role, just really remaining very focused and present, not yourself getting distracted by things and therefore causing a distraction to the athletes. If I think about the comment I made earlier about deliberately distracting or deliberately not so much distracting but causing doubt, it's when coaches challenge athletes. And you know, we talk about the push and pull of coaching and how it needs to be really well managed. So for me, it's a necessary skill and it's a necessary ingredient of good coaches that they understand how and best to do that. But my sense is a lot of that's done away from the competition environment. A lot of that's done when there's time for the athlete to absorb the self-doubt, to question themselves, to be able to think about what the coach has said and then discussion, co-design the way of getting better. In competition, you haven't quite got the time. You're in the heat of the battle. So a lot of those things are done away from the competition environment, but it's necessary for those athletes to become uncomfortable, as people often talk about, to feel that they can get better, they have the humility to accept they need to get better, but then also deal with the self-doubt that comes with that. So I think there are times when we need to get in the way. But I think for mine, it's probably one of those skills that, you know, some makes coaches better than others. It's ability to sometimes understand best when and how to challenge. And it's really only comes about from experience, but it also comes about from a great knowledge of the individual. And again, a lot of that is to do with the relationship you've built with your athlete over a long period of time.
Barry, you've spoken about the mental health issues you face as a coach. There's actually a great video you did, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But I wanted to ask you what you've learned about the impact of stress and how it can be better managed when you are a leader.
First thing to talk about, and I probably learned a lot more about stress, effects on coaching, burnout, having gone through the experience. And I'm so thankful that I hear people talking about this now, and I'm very keen to help people go down the path that I went down. And so a lot of my learnings are not so much from going through it, but from actually learning about it afterwards. So the things I learned about it since are about it is cumulative. It can be very insidious about the build-up in your body. So I've learned about cortisol and the accumulation of cortisol in my body, I believe, over a long period of three Olympiads as a head coach. I'm certainly, as I said, keen to help people from my experience. The things that I would have done better, and there were a lot of them, but the key advice I give is about, you know, give yourself breaks, give yourself time, give yourself the opportunity to do things for yourself that break that relentlessness of coaching. And of course, they can be varied. For me, it's now things about giving myself time. In retirement, it's a lot easier. Obviously, I'm not working the 6.5 day week or self-absorbed with something, but family activities, golf, the garden, physical exercise are particularly something that I would recommend that I didn't do well back then. And clearly be prepared to delegate and trust in that delegation to other people. So you're not always feeling you've got to drive the program. Let other people become drivers of the program and certain portfolios they might have. And the final comment I'd make, one of the learnings, key learnings, is that coaching, like a lot of other professions, is a caring profession. And people who take it on can be very dutiful. They feel the responsibility of looking after people. And what goes with that sometimes is some personalities that are, some of those people might be perfectionists. Some of them also might be very analytical. So when you put that mixture together, it's quite a dangerous mixture. And so I think the coaching profession, like other caring professions, and particularly the types of personalities that take on coaching, there's a potent mix there that's quite dangerous. And so that's why I think people in organisations need to be always asking the question about the development of their coaches, but also their life balance. And coaches, including myself, ironically talk to their athletes all the time about life balance and ensuring that they've got it right. And ironically, people like myself didn't adhere to that. So I really would encourage coaches and people within organisations who are responsible for the development of those people who are coaches really heed the messages that are out there now.
Barry, your son Brent actually went on to play for Australia as well. And I'm not sure if he's coaching actually, but if he did come to you and ask for advice about coaching, I'm wondering what the top one or two things are that you'd tell him.
Well, he hasn't taken on coaching per se. His day job at the moment is he's a general manager of a meat processing company in Busselton, WA. That meat processing plant's got about 600 employees. So he's actually leading and managing a much bigger organisation than I led as a national head coach. And we have occasional chats, particularly when Donna or I or our daughter visit, and we've got some time to chat more casually about his role and the daily challenges of what that brings and various aspects associated with his role at that company. And so I've never sort of, we talk about the daily challenges and what's ahead, but if I think about a young coach or a young leader, as our son is, two things come to mind. Deserve victory, which is about paying the price, which is a Vince Lombardi thing, paying the price. But for me, deserve victory was a poster I came across in the War Museum under Whitehall or whatever, way back when I visited London a long time ago. And it was a poster with Winston Churchill pointing his finger at the rest of Britain when they're in the depths of, obviously, the Battle of Britain. And so it's about, yeah, you're going to have to put in the hard yards. You're going to have to make personal sacrifices for the sake of other people in your organisation on a day-to-day basis. But then the other thing that comes to mind, and in life you always look for the adages or the little, you know, four-liners or whatever you want to guide you. And I develop a little quote that I put in a frame on my desk at the AIS when I still head coach there, and basically said, what have I done today to improve the way that I or my people do things? What have I done today that's sort of about changing the way we do things, sort of improvement? So to me, that was about, again, bringing me back to what's my purpose, you know, what's my core role here as a coach. It's about improving people. It's about improving us as a group. It's about every day focusing on that. And I think the deserved victory one's about how much you're prepared to pay, how much you're prepared to say no to do certain things in your life to allow you to focus on that role really well. So for me, that's sort of probably core things that I would say to Brent as to other younger people and how things happen. I took a photograph of the deserved victory poster. And I actually put it in the frame and I said it to Brent once, because to me that was probably as a parent a key message.
Love that idea of a deserved victory. I'm going to look up that picture of Churchill and see exactly what it looks like. But Barry, if I could ask just one last question. After a lifetime spent, as you've said, teaching, learning, helping, you've referenced words like thrive and influence all through this interview. But after a lifetime spent in the sport at its pinnacle and at a grassroots level, what do you hope is the legacy that you are leaving behind?
So my comment would be when I came to the sport as a player, and that was in Ipswich as a youngster, or when I came to the sport as a full-time coach sort of in 1990, which is a few decades later, as a coach, there were a lot of people that had laid a foundation before me. So to allow me to succeed and improve as a player, but also to then go on and lead this program and hopefully bring future success. So if I think about coming to that, it's first recognizing that, a bit like we said earlier about recognizing the past, understanding your responsibility, what your purpose in life is, and therefore what you're going to do for others as a means of creating opportunity in the future. So I think firstly, fundamentally my hope was in the environment that I created with others, is that people could grow, people could thrive, people could at the end be better people for the experience of living in that environment, working with those people. And I suppose the hope I had also was that some of the things we did in my time with other people in creating that culture was about setting some cultural norms that better positioned the program for other people to take it on to another level. And if I can be a bit vain here, I take great pride in looking at the current group of athletes, the program that Colin Batch has been leading since 2000 and whatever, 17, and the way they approach the Tokyo Olympics, and the cultural norms in that group are outstanding. And it's so disappointing for that group to miss out just by a whisker in Tokyo. But to me, I take great pride in that. And I'd like to think some of the legacy we left, the group that I was around back when I finished, has been a stepping stone for that group to take it to another level.
Barry, it's been wonderful talking to you today. It's been a really great lesson on focusing on purpose and connecting it, I think, with why you are doing something and where you are in that moment. And I think it's a really strong lesson for everyone listening, regardless of whether we're in the corporate world or the sporting world or helping out in community-based groups. So thank you very much for your time today. I very much enjoyed it. And I wish you all the best for taming that garden, which I can see behind you there, and getting it into some kind of shape ready for the spring.
Yeah, no, well, thank you for the opportunity and good luck with your settling and the family and relocating back.
Thank you, Barry.
Hi, everyone. You have been listening to the great coach, Barry Dancer. I hope you got a lot out of Barry's reflective style and found a few ideas that you can bring to your own dinner table, locker room or boardroom table for discussion. When I listened back, the other key highlights for me were how he describes his purpose as assisting people and collectives grow, which he likens to helping them put together a puzzle. The story he tells about watching healthcare workers who assisted his daughter collaborate on her well-being and how this influenced him to rethink his role and move towards becoming more of a developer of people. And finding the right moment to challenge people so that they can absorb the self-doubt. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And just before we go, if you have any feedback, then please let us know. Just like Naomi D, who said, "Thanks, great insights that are applicable to all walks of life." Thanks, Naomi. We love the interaction with the people around the world who listen. And so if you have any feedback or comments, please let us know. And if they're positive ones, then please let your friends and family know too. All the details on how to connect with us are in the show notes or on our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.